Hello, everybody. This is Patrick Duffy, the former man from Atlantis. You're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Well, hello to all you fanboys and fangirls out there. Welcome to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. I am your host, Joe Stuber. I am in the lair. I am so glad you can join me today. Kicking off some episodes where I'm going to take a look back at one of television's most unique science fiction shows. It made a huge splash in the 70s. Sorry for the early pun. Come on, you had to see that one coming, right? The show was Man from Atlantis. Joining me today is the star of the show, the man himself, Patrick Duffy. He's going to be along momentarily. And you're also going to want to check back next week as well. Well, you're listening every week to Comic Book Central, right? If you're not, well, hey, look, if you haven't already subscribed to the show on iTunes, you won't miss an episode. You definitely won't miss next week's episode, because next week I'm going to have Mr. Duffy's lovely co-star joining me in the lair, Belinda Montgomery. So we've got some Man from Atlantis episodes coming up. Past that, I have to say I'm working on a special surprise of Atlantean proportions. Can't say exactly what it is just yet. I haven't been able to lock it in, but, well, if you think about it, you might be able to figure it out if we're going in this direction. Can't say just yet, but suffice to say, a lot of Man from Atlantis goodness swimming your way as the weeks progress. As I mentioned, starting things off today with the star of the show, Patrick Duffy. He's going to be along in just a few minutes. Before I get to that chat, I wanted to mention another conversation I had. This one can be found over at the Podcast Game Show. That is another really cool podcast. Host Brandon Biard, he was kind enough to invite yours truly to take part in a trivia contest over on his podcast. The show is really cool. It's part Jeopardy. It's part Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. I really had a good time. It was fun. I did okay. I don't think I embarrassed myself. I did lose a little bit of comic book cred on one question. I gained it back on another question. You'll be the judge of that. Check it out. It's podcastgameshow.com/Stuber. That's mine. So podcastgameshow.com. All the episodes are there, but podcastgameshow.com/Stuber. That's my episode. I'll put a link to that up in the show notes for this particular episode at my website, comicbookcentral.net. Again, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can listen to it on Stitcher, Blueberry. Give it a like on Facebook, facebook.com/comicbookcentralnetwork. You can follow the show on Twitter at comicbookctrl. For Facebook, I promise I'm going to be getting those Marvel Universe Live pictures posted. I know I mentioned that on last week's show. Last week's Steelers game took a lot more out of me than I thought it would. I still don't think I fully recovered from it. I'm surprised I still have a voice left after. But when you get those pictures up there, I promise. So check that out. Without further ado, I'm going to go get my Super Stuberman swimming trunks on. While I do that, you take a listen to this, then I will be back to dive right into my comic book conversation with Patrick Duffy. Patrick Duffy was born in Big Sky Country, Montana. After his family moved to Seattle, Patrick's interest in acting started to take shape in high school, then the University of Washington, and eventually as artist in residence for the state of Washington. Now, from there, it was on to New York, then on to Hollywood, where he ultimately auditioned for a new NBC sci-fi show from the executive producers of the original Star Trek series. The show was called Man from Atlantis, and it begins quite literally as a fish-out-of-water story. Patrick plays a man with amnesia who washes up on the beach. He can't breathe, and he's then rescued by Dr. Elizabeth Merrill, played by Belinda Montgomery. The man has webbed hands, he's got eyes that are highly sensitive to light, he can breathe underwater, he swims faster than a dolphin. Some pretty good superhero stuff, to say the least. And because no one knows the backstory of the mystery man, he's given the name Mark Harris, and he's assigned to work with Dr. Merrill at the Foundation for Oceanic Research, where it is revealed that Mark just might be the last survivor of Atlantis. The show started as a series of four highly successful television movies in the spring and summer of 77, before it was picked up as a weekly series. Anticipation for a regular Man from Atlantis series was so high, merchandise began to hit the shelves. You had paperback novels, lunchboxes, There was a proposed line of action figures, and Marvel Comics launched a monthly title based on the show, written by none other than the co-creator of Rocket Raccoon, Bill Mantlo. Now, once the weekly episodes began, however, the storylines started to deviate wildly from the original television movies. The audience didn't stick around, and the ratings sunk like the crew of the submersible Cetacean. Still, think about it. We've got some off-the-wall, way-out-there episodes. Or would that be under-there episodes? Either way, we still got some great episodes out there. We got another chance to see the great Victor Buono in action. Loved him as King Tut on the old Batman show. And we got some fantastic underwater stunts. Man from Atlantis also gave Patrick the opportunity to dive right into his next role, Bobby Ewing on the CBS smash hit Dallas. The character of Bobby was so popular, he was even brought back from the dead. Kind of. And my guest today found television success in science fiction, drama, and situation comedy, and he is well known for one of the most famous shower scenes since Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. A big welcome to actor, producer, and director, Patrick Duffy. Patrick, welcome to Comic Book Central.
I can hear the crowd going crazy in the background.
They are. Well, it's almost, look, I'm going to go back a little bit. I'm going to time travel to 1977. Talk about crowds going crazy. I'm going to go back to a show called Challenge of the Network Stars. It later was known as Battle of the Network Stars. Okay.
Right.
Talk about crowds going crazy. They were going crazy for you. Tell me if I got this right. You're on the NBC team in 77. You're the star of Man from Atlantis.
Right.
Am I correct in that you were not part of the swimming relay until you were with CBS in 79?
Yeah, I think so. I think that was an oversight on their part, but it's probably saved five episodes of my career because I'm not really a competition swimmer, and I probably would have drowned about halfway through the race. So everybody just assumed they made a huge mistake, and I'm willing to go with that. So let's just keep the myth going, okay?
Oh, well, we could do it. But I'm thinking maybe something a little more sinister. Did producers think that your Atlantean powers could give NBC the advantage of that year? I mean, there had to be something here.
I don't know.
I couldn't believe this until you were in 79.
You know,
yeah.
Yeah, the thing was in those days, and that was what was so nice about those particular events where there is competition, it was such soft competition. It was so much just getting together and having fun, laughing. Nobody took it seriously. So I forget who was the head of our team. I think it might have been Bobby Conrad.
Conrad's always the head.
Time.
Yeah. And
And he would just make up the teams. You know, he just made up the teams. And he would say, don't worry, the hens are going to win it for us. The girls always do better than the men. So he put Melissa Gilbert in the swimming competition, and she just chewed him up. So I went with him, and I love Bobby today. And it was great fun to do those particular shows with Howard Cosell and all those people. And we would all just, nobody took it seriously. Nobody trained before. We'd all go out and get a drink afterwards and laugh and scratch. And then everything got a little too serious when they started really, you know, getting competition television reality shows. But those were probably the first of that type.
Yeah, very early on. Well, we talked to Kathy Lee Crosby about it, too, and she had a blast with those. You talk about that people weren't as competitive, but come on, Conrad had to be way competitive on some level.
Oh, well, he's got testosterone for, you know, wake-up juice. So he was crazy. But he was good-natured crazy. He knew what the game was, and he didn't like losing. And I'm not sure. I don't even remember who won. It didn't matter to me.
Yeah.
The mercenary side of it was we all got paid the same amount of money. There was no winning purse, and it was just bragging rights.
Could you do that show today?
Personally?
No. Could they? Do you think it could happen in
general?
Industry. Yeah, the industry.
No. I don't think so. First of all, I don't think there is that kind of acquiescence on the part of the stars of different shows. I think they have different agendas, I don't think they'd want to put themselves out there. There are too many other options. They now have stuntman shows and, you know, survival shows and things like that. That for those of that mind, that's what they would do. So I just don't think it would wash anymore. And plus, they would all demand so much money and billing, and it would just be such a headache anymore.
Cost
and
prohibitive.
We were all ignorant in those days. We thought, Yeah, we thought, oh, wow, we get to work on Lincoln. We're making $5,000. Woohoo! And off we go.
We loved it. I loved it as a kid. It was fun to watch. Talk about sports.
I loved it. I totally.
Your interest in sports from a very early age?
That's one of the misnomers of bad bio writing. Because I did Man from Atlantis, somewhere some network publicist said that I was a competition swimmer, and I was not.
Okay, I heard rodeos.
I was not very
track.
Good at. Oh well, I did. I when you're in school, you do all those things because it's almost required.
Okay.
To go out for the track team, So I went out for the track team in junior high school. Tried pole vaulting in that. I wasn't exceptionally fast. I played football in junior high in my first year of high school. Didn't like getting hurt, so you know I slowly winnowed out my sports. And I realized that if you work out, you can look like you play any sport. Now, if I'm going to be an actor, I'm better off looking like I can do it rather than concentrating on one thing. So I really was not sports oriented at all.
Okay. You kind of answered how I was going to ask how you segued into acting, because it was almost like, you know, was it the injuries? It was just like it hurt less, right?
Oh, it hurt less. What I learned in my junior year in high school was that cheerleaders go to all the sports events, go home with all the girls, and don't sweat even, let alone get hurt. So my last year in college, I was on the Yell, they called us Yell Kings in those days, but we were glorified cheerleaders. And as all you did was lift women over your head and then go home on the bus. It was the best job ever.
This kind of, as we'll talk, this kind of goes through your career. You always kind of pick the choice roles, regardless of what you're doing. So very smart. You're a very smart man. Okay, early Hollywood. What was early Hollywood like for you? How talk about those. I mean, you're doing a lot of plays, I think, even before you get to Hollywood.
Yeah. I mean, I thought literally when I graduated from the drama program at the University of Washington that I would be a theatrical performer. That was going to be my career. Do stage work, and it was enjoyable. I loved it. I met my wife when I was narrating a performance of her ballet companies. We became infatuated with each other. And she asked me, she said, "So you think you're a pretty good actor?" And I said, "Sure I do." And she said, "Well, how do you know if you've never been to New York?" And this was in Seattle. So I packed my bags and I followed her to New York and proceeded to be a carpenter and a dishwasher and all those things. But I did one play, an off-Broadway showcase, wasn't even a play, nobody got paid. But an agent came to see another actor and called me into her office in the following week. And I signed with an agency. And that agent then started submitting me for film work, television, soap operas, things like that. And very shortly, she opened a Los Angeles office and said, "You need to come to L.A. I think this is where your career is going to go." So I packed my bags once again, and I moved to L.A. And my wife, when her ballet career was over, followed me here. And again, a few more years of driving a truck and being a carpenter. And my first real official job was the Last of Mrs. Lincoln with Julie Harris. But in the meantime, I'd gone to San Diego and did 6 months of the Shakespeare Festival because that was my training. And with Julie Harris's play that was filmed for PBS, it started things going. I auditioned for The Man from Atlantis over and over and over again and finally got down to the final group of people and was selected for that. And literally from that day till the end of Step by Step, I was only out of work for 3 weeks.
Wow.
That was 24 years.
Man, what a run.
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing. And all
very
things considered
in
Hollywood,
yeah,
that's crazy. But it goes to your talent too.
Crazy.
I mean, and we'll talk a little bit about this. I mean, you branched out beyond acting, so it just became even, you added so many different things to your resume. You auditioned for Star Wars?
I did. I didn't know that I auditioned for it. I actually went to have a meeting, and I'm trying to remember, I think it was at old Goldwyn Studios. And they just said, "There's a science fiction show, they're meeting people, go to this office." So I went to this office and they called me in and it was empty. It looked like an abandoned office. There was a desk, a couple of chairs, a file cabinet, but no personal items whatsoever. I sat in the chair for a while, and somebody came in. I would like to think it was Lucas, but I have no idea because I can't remember that clearly.
It's a better
but
story.
Somebody came in and rummaged around in the file cabinet and then left. And then the secretary came in and said, "Thank you, Mr. Duffy." And I looked at her like, "For what?" And she said, "That'll be all. Thank you very much." And I left. And I found out that was my audition for Star Wars. And apparently, if it wasn't Lucas, it was whoever he, you know, assigned for that job, came in, took a look at this skinny kid, I weighed maybe 160 pounds at the time, sitting in a chair, and just thought I wasn't, you know, Star Wars science fiction hero worthy. And, you know, it was a pass without even saying hello. And I thought that was funny. And you know, it was what it was. I don't even know at that time even what I would have been considered for, whether it would have been Luke Skywalker, Han Solo, or Jabba the Hutt. I mean, I had no idea what they were looking for. And you just went in because it was a very secretive script. Nobody knew what that was about. So that was my one of many of my rejections in the business, yeah.
When the movie premiered, because this would have been a few months before Atlantis, thoughts, or were you just too buried into production on Man from Atlantis at that point?
You know, it didn't even enter my mind. Literally, I've kept a day-by-day book, you know, those week-at-a-glance books.
Yeah.
I've kept all of my day-by-day books since I graduated from, before graduating from college, so since 1970. And I have every single one of them. And I have listed every single audition and meeting that I have ever gone to. And quite literally, in those first 2 years that I was in Los Angeles, I had maybe 200 to 250 meetings or auditions or just interviews a year. And they're all noted in there. Some of them, you know, are laughable because I've since come to work for some of those same people over the years. And until I went back and they reminded me of it, I didn't even know that I had met them. So going in for that meeting, it came and went in my mind like so many others, and I never dwelled on it. I've never been downcast or depressed by any of that. I just figured it was part of the territory. So it didn't dawn on me to even think that, oh, I auditioned for that, until many, many, many years later. Later, I did know that I was auditioning for Raiders of the Lost Ark, and went in and actually had a meeting, and it was kind of strange because it was in a kitchen, and we all sat around while things were being cooked and had a discussion, and I didn't get that one either. So, you know, it comes and goes, and then you look back on your career and you go, oh my God, 3 weeks off in 24 years. I guess there's no room for complaint in this. So let's just assume you've done okay.
Yeah, I don't think Tom Selleck was complaining too much that he lost it either. I'm a huge Indiana Jones fan. It's the other podcast we're on is the IndieCast. So you've actually just taught me.
I'm a fan of Star Wars, Indiana Jones. Okay. All of the things I found out I didn't get, I loved it. And I would look at the things and say, oh, yeah, well, that's obviously the right choice. Okay. I never once said, oh, my God, did they miss the boat not picking me?
Yeah.
No, I really do think 99% of the time those choices are right. They're correct.
Yeah. So did you audition for Spielberg? Because we always hear these stories about how he's baking cookies and putting actors at ease in the kitchen.
Well, I do believe he was there at that time. There were a myriad of people. Like, he had several assistants. There were probably a half a dozen people, and it was a giant sort of almost like a TV studio kitchen, mm-hmm. where you would do a TV show about cooking, and it was over by Universal.
Yeah, we see the pictures in the making of book. We see the pictures of the kitchen that you guys were
auditioning. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. And you would sit around it. This, again, I've never seen that book, and I'm trying to remember, but the construction was such that I remember sitting on a stool by a counter where the kitchening stuff was being done, and you were just having a conversation, and I was a little more at ease because I had been working for a while, so I wasn't quite as wondering what the hell they want or what they're looking for, and I just assumed, well, if I look like what they think they want, maybe I'll get an audition as opposed to this meeting, and it never happened, and, you know. All of a sudden, Harrison Ford, go figure.
Yeah. You know, do you recall, was it the bar scene?
Best person in the world.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that in looking back...
I never actually read.
Oh, okay.
No, we never actually read words. It was quite literally a meeting of chatting. We were chatting. We were sitting around talking. And that's it. I guess I'm not a good chatter. I got to work on my chat.
Well, look, like you said, 3 weeks off in a quarter century, that's pretty amazing. So, look, let's talk about some of these roles you did get. Before we get to the superhero that you just can't keep down.
That won't take long, you know. There's only three.
You take a look at
damn quick.
Yeah, take a look at your IMDb page. It's pretty impressive. Let's talk about the other character we couldn't keep down. First, before we get to the superhero we couldn't keep down, Bobby Ewing on Dallas. Okay, this...
Right.
Okay, how... Again, could you pull this off? We're talking about this episode where your character is completely killed off. He's done. He's gone.
Right.
He's out of there. And he's got storylines in a spinoff show. So you're working storylines in two shows. How did that come about where they brought him back? And, like, how did that... Did you initiate it? Did the producers... How did this all come about?
Well, I would like to think it was all because they missed me, either rating-wise or, you know, any of the number of reasons, all of which was a part of the formula, a part of the mix that made this all happen. But the sequence of events was that after year seven, which is the standard television contract, in short, I was a member of a incredibly successful ensemble show. Ensemble to the extent that it was Larry, who, you know, for 35 years was the best friend I've ever had on the planet. So my best friend was the head of the show, which made me more than thrilled. But the rest was an ensemble. Hmm. And at the end of my 7 years, I thought if there is ever a chance, and this is why I'm not the most successful businessman in the world, but I thought if there's ever a chance to flip this success into something where I'm more... central in terms of storyline, a la The Man from Atlantis, this is probably the time to make my move. So I talked to the producers. It was not like I jumped ship. I talked to them. They tried to talk me out of it, but the executive producer, who was Leonard Katzman, who was another very, very good friend of mine, understood my reasoning, even though he disagreed with it. And so, yes, okay, we have to do this. And then he and I spoke about how to get rid of my character. And I thought I was being noble and right in saying that I don't want to tease the audience with disappearing or a plane crash or going missing or any of that stuff. So I've always been the hero of the show. Let me be a hero. Let me save somebody's life and die. And then, you know, everybody can go into mourning and we can have a burial and you'll be thrilled with it and I'll be gone. And so that's how it happened. And he devised the saving Pamela from the car and the whole thing. And Bobby dies, which I have to admit, it was a great death scene. You should be really telling me how good I was in it.
And this is why you haven't had a day off in a quarter century, because you were that good.
And I was done with it. And so for a year, not quite a year, but a television year, I bounced around. I did some guest star stuff. I did some TV movies. I did some commercials. But I didn't do what I thought I was going to do. Well, that's my side of the story. Simultaneous to that, Leonard Katzman, the brains and heart behind the development of Dallas, left the same year I did. And the two things Larry counted on was working with me and doing the work that Leonard produced. And both of those things were gone. The ratings dipped. The storylines went to hell. And Larry was upset. And if you're a star of Hagman's caliber and you're upset on your show, they want to make it right. Mm. So they devised, well, let's see if there's a way to bring Patrick back on the show. But everybody knew that I wouldn't do it, that I had sort of made my own bed and I was forced to lie in it. But they also knew that Larry could talk me into anything. So they said, Larry, you're up. And Larry called me. And literally the message he left on my phone was, Patrick, this is Larry. Come out to Malibu. Let's get drunk. I want to talk to you. So literally that was the message on my phone. When I turned off the message machine, which we used to have in those days, I turned to my wife and I said, he's going to try and talk me into coming back on the show. And my wife said, she's very literate and literal, she said, you can't come back on that show unless the last season was a dream. So I got drunk and he pitched the idea. And I said, if you want me back, I so miss this company and I miss the work and I miss Bobby Ewing. And I would love to come back. And that's what started the ball rolling. And then Leonard had the same idea, not because he spoke to my wife, but he knew also that we couldn't trick the audience. We'd have to come back as Bobby Ewing. He hated the last year's storyline, as Larry did. And so he said, let's pretend it didn't exist. Let's just go on with year eight, but it's the second year eight, and we'll continue the show. And we did five more years.
Wow. But nobody floated the idea of Evil Twin or anything like that?
Oh, what they did, and because you probably know, because I can tell you do your research, there was the evil twin syndrome, there was the plastic surgery on the evil person plot, and we filmed vignettes of two of those proposed ideas. And the only reason we did that is because there were spies that were always on sets in those days, selling storylines to the Inquirer and a few things that were out there. There weren't nearly as many as there are today, and there were people, we never found out who they were, but the minute we filmed, we did a thing with me lying in a hospital bed in the Dallas sound stages with the doctors taking bandages off my face, and I hold up a mirror and I look at myself in the mirror and I go, it's perfect. I look just like him. And then we printed that. We knew somebody was going to steal that and try and sell it. And we did the evil twin. But what nobody knew was that Leonard, singularly, just Leonard Katzman and myself, went to a commercial production house in a completely different part of Los Angeles that only does television commercials, with a case of Irish Spring soap, and built a shower in the middle of this warehouse soundstage, just a shower and a hot water spigot and things like that. And we filmed for an entire day an Irish Spring commercial as Patrick Duffy doing a commercial in order to get the door open, me turn around and saying, good morning. And then we would pause long enough that Leonard knew he had the freeze frame, and then I would hold up the bar of Irish Spring soap. I'd say, you can have a good morning, too, if you wake up every day like the Duffy family with Irish Spring. And then we go, oh, no, there's not enough suds on the bar. And we would do this whole thing for an entire day to get that scene, because we knew what we were going to do in terms of Bobby coming back from the dead. Oh. So there's the story.
That itself would make a great television series. Right there. Talk about who shot JR, you know, keeping us in suspense over an entire summer, bringing your character back from the dead. It's all a dream. The entire season's a dream. All these storylines, you know, go by the wayside. Could you do something like that in 2016 with all the social media, everything out there, all the surprises, all the spoilers, or even just the instant, I hate this, within seconds of it happening? Could you pull something like
that
off?
Well, the problem is, once it airs, then social media can kill something. You know, restaurants are closed in a week. Yeah. Plays are closed in after opening night if enough people just start tagging, saying, hate this show, hashtag hate this show, you're dead. So in that sense, you could do it, but it might be a quick second demise. But, yeah, you can still keep secrets. There are scripts. I mean, the Star Wars script was very closely held, the newest one. And I'm not going to be a spoiler alert. I haven't seen it yet, but my granddaughter, 10 years old, came out, and she was so excited she saw it. And she said, and you'll never guess. And she went, blah, 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 and gave the big secret of the show. And, and it didn't bother me because... you know, at all. But her father was like, oh, Fiona, no, you're not supposed to be a spoiler.
Well, that was a character you were probably up for anyway, so you may have had a vested interest in him. Who knows? Yeah,
exactly. Maybe I can get it again.
Maybe you can get it again. Maybe you can go talk to
there's an opening now.
Talk to JJ.
Yes.
Oh, there's definitely an opening.
I can shit in the clothes.
You could definitely be there.
So in that sense, you know, I think television, there's just... I think there's more to be made now in reveal, even for production companies, in revealing what's going to happen and then letting them anticipate it than trying to keep a secret. Keeping a secret is a little old school, I think, and it's probably not the way to go anymore.
Okay. Well, you talk about fitting in the clothes. You didn't have to worry about fitting into too many clothes on the show that we really want to talk about today, Man from Atlantis. This is the show that made television history, correct?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. In many different ways. I mean, we were one of simultaneous right around at the same time as The Incredible Hulk and $6 Million Man. But I think we eclipsed the Hulk by just a few months in terms of coming out, because Louis was on most of those Battle of the Network Stars things with me as well. Mm-hmm. But we were one of the first of the science fiction regular television shows, unless you go all the way back to Buck Rogers or some damn thing. So that was interesting. It was interesting also to do that kind of show with no special effects. Right. In other words, there was no digital remastering of things. There, if you went underwater, you were underwater. The, you know, modern audiences now say, how did you fake those water things? And I'm thinking, well, you get a big tub of water, and you go in it.
How does your hair look so realistic underwater?
Well, it just, it just floats around, doesn't it? And they're going, is that a wind machine? Or no, it's water, dummy. But the reason, the second reason that it was quite a, you know, a classic in one sense is it was the first television show ever purchased by the Republic of China.
Yeah, how does that
air
happen?
On their state-run television. I don't really know, except in that, and I don't mean this to sound like I'm xenophobic or something, but there was so little dialogue and so much action, and the hero almost spoke nothing at all, that I think it was easy to adapt to such a foreign-based audience that was not used to, you know, dubbed things or any of that. And to see an American show that required, I would guess, very little post-production help probably made it attractive. And I think they love a superhero. I mean, the whole Tales of the Genji and early Chinese written works are all heroic. The Japanese equivalent to samurai. I don't know what the Chinese equivalent is.
Yeah.
But they like that kind of thing. So I think it fit their national sort of image of drama, and we were good, and we were the first ones. I just went back a little over a year ago. The government of China flew my wife and I there to celebrate the 35th or something anniversary of the Man from Atlantis having aired there.
Wow.
You know, it was a huge national event, big television special, and the whole thing.
That's amazing. So, well, I mean,
it was a big deal.
Not totally surprising, because it, I mean, we know that in the second, and we'll talk a little bit about this, but you know, in the second season, I guess you would call it, it was cut a little bit short. But man, those, that first season of telefilms, television movies, whatever you want to refer to them, those were wildly successful. That was kind of the thing back then too, wasn't it? Like $6 Million Man, I think Love Boat, Battlestar. Was were they just sort of like field testing series as they went?
Yes. Yes, they didn't know what to do with us, and it was sort of disconcerting. But I think in the end, it worked out right, because I went right from that to Dallas. But we did the pilot, and the pilot I thought was really good, you know, from that time period, good science fiction, very fun. And then they couldn't decide whether to pick up an order for a series, so NBC called the production house in Herb Solow and said, "Would you do another TV movie?" And so they wrote a second TV movie, and that was like, okay, we do the second TV movie. And that took us to the middle of some television season that they couldn't get a second half of the season order written and filmed in time to do it. So NBC came back to them again and said, could you do two more TV movies? And so they did a total of four, and then that dovetailed to the beginning of orders for a regular television series, and that's when they ordered the 13 episodes.
Okay.
But we sort of lost our way, in my opinion, after the first four movies. We lost our way we got a bit too camp and a bit too Batman of that era, as opposed to really maintaining a science fiction genetic line. So it dropped in ratings rather rapidly, and was we knew we were being canceled, though they hadn't announced it yet. So that's how there's only 1 week between Man from Atlantis and Dallas. I wasn't filming right up until that last week, but we were waiting for the official cancellation. And as soon as it came, Leonard Katzman had already known that he wanted me for his new television show that he was doing at Warner Brothers. So the call came in right away.
Okay.
I didn't have to audition or anything. And I just was hired to do Bobby.
Yeah, like you referenced, I mean, completely different tone between what the unofficial season one and the actual season two, I guess, when you go through that. But one thing that's consistent is your look, that you are absolutely ripped in this series. We're looking at this thing.
Yeah.
What was your training regimen like? How did you get into that kind of shape? Because, those little yellow trunks aren't leaving a whole lot to the imagination, but you look like a superhero in this. I mean, you're definitely not Bobby Ewing.
Yeah. And this is a story that not a lot of people know. I've told it a few times, but it seems to fall in the abyss somewhere. Is when I was auditioning originally for Man from Atlantis, first you would go in and have a meeting, and then they would call you in to read, and then you would meet the executive producers. And at that time, I was still about 160, 165 pounds. So when I finally met somebody at the network, Herb Solo, bless him, he was always adamant. Once he made up his mind that he wanted me, he was not about to let NBC say no. So he kept pushing, and he finally said, "I want to bring Patrick in to meet you." And they said, "Well, it's not really necessary. We've seen, the video." They didn't even do, I'll tell you the other part of this story, is they said, "Oh, well, I did a video that they sent to him. We did a little mock-up of a water scene where I'm standing at the edge of a boat and there's water reflection on my face." And Belinda Montgomery was already okayed for the part. So I read a little scene with her with reflected water light on my face. And they sent it to NBC, and the word came back, "Well, it was a nice audition, but he's not an 8 o'clock hero." Isn't that a great phrase? They said, "He's not an 8 o'clock hero. He's a 10 o'clock hero."
Okay.
And the difference is I wasn't beefy enough.
You weren't beefcake.
I wasn't beefcake. I was the intellectual svelte hero, So
the thinking man's superhero.
So Leonard's, I was the thinking man superhero, right? And so Herb Solo phoned them or talked to whoever those executives do, and they said, "Patrick's on an incredibly intense workout schedule, and he looks different now than he did when we did the production, so I want to bring him in so you can see." Right after they had finally gotten back to him. So Herb Solo called in Fred Phillips, who ended up being the makeup man on the show, the man who made Spock's ears for Star Trek, all of that, very famous Hollywood makeup man. And Fred's job was to make me a foam body. We spent a half a day. I had a meeting at NBC in the afternoon. I went in the morning to MGM, and we spent the whole day with Fred fashioning foam that you use in upholstery for chest muscles, shoulders, delts, biceps, all of this kind of stuff, and then wrapping me all up and then putting a T-shirt over that and then a turtleneck sweater over that and then a navy shirt over that. And I looked like I had gained 35 pounds.
Wow.
And it was all sculpted. I looked like I looked, towards the end of Man from Atlantis. Mm. And they painted my face the way they wanted to. We put in the hand-painted contact lenses. I was blind as a bat. And they drove me over to NBC and walked me into the executive offices. And I sat down for 5 minutes max and talked to it was a woman at the time. I forget who was in charge of NBC. And she was behind the desk. I walked in with Herb and Robert Justman, and we chatted. And then Herb said, "Patrick, why don't you go out in the lobby in the office area outside and wait for us. We'll be right out," because they were going to talk to her. So I went out, sat in the chair next to the secretary, And we had a nice conversation, and Herb comes out in 5 minutes, and Justin, and we get outside to the car, and the first thing he says is, "How'd it go in the outer office?" I said, "What do you mean, how'd it go in the outer office?" He said, "Did you talk? Did you talk to the secretary?" I said, "Well, sure, why?" And he said, "Because that's what she's going to do. She's going to go into that office and ask her secretary what she thinks about you." And sure enough, apparently I passed the secretary test.
That was it.
I improved on my chatting, apparently.
I was going to say, much better than Spielberg and Lucas then.
Yeah, I don't know what, I was bitten by the bug or something. But so literally they okayed me for the show, and we had about 2 to 3 months then before we were starting shooting, and that's when I started exercising.
Okay.
And that's when I went on an incredibly high-protein diet. I worked out every day, but I didn't. It was before they didn't call in a trainer. They didn't do anything. They just said, "Go lift weights." So in my little Hollywood apartment, I would wake up in the morning before my wife, go into this little closet that we had where I could lay down and not make noise. I couldn't go in the living room because we had a baby, and he slept in a crib in the middle of the living room. So I was in the closet with all these clothes hanging over me, working out with weights for a couple hours every morning.
Becoming a superhero.
And building up, becoming a superhero.
Oh, that's
and
amazing.
All during the filming, they would just pump protein into me all the time. And I would work out between shots. I would lift weights all the time. And I developed the habit of doing that. So when Atlantis was canceled, I continued that through Dallas, and just sort of, I knew that that was the physique that people associated with my character or my actor persona. So I was always that sort of heroic physique type person.
Okay. You know? Let's talk about the swimming scenes. Did you, how much of your swimming did you do? How much was stuntman? Where were you doing it? How did you develop that really unique style?
Yeah, The style was developed, first they wanted the man from Atlantis to undulate sideways like a fish does. And we had a great stunt coordinator who was very famous in the business for always doing water work stunts. We worked out in a swimming pool together. Now, I was a skin diver, a scuba diver. My sister trained me. She was a NAWI instructor. So I did a lot of underwater work. I'm very comfortable underwater. No panic. But we quickly realized that you can't undulate sideways, but you mammals undulate up and down, whales, porpoises, those types of things. So that's how we developed that swimming technique. And we just worked on it until it looked smooth. It doesn't propel you that quickly.
I noticed they're very quick cuts.
Fast forward film.
Yeah.
Very quick cuts, or they speed up the film every once in a while.
A little undercranking.
Now, to answer the other side of the question is, I would do everything, but then the stuntman would also do certain things, and they would pick the shots that look the best.
Okay.
So there's a lot of shots that I look at and I go, "Oh, that's Tom Morgan. I can tell Tom right away. He was the guy who physically looked the closest to me." But we would film on the same days, and because we filmed in Catalina underwater in the winter. And a little tiny yellow swimming suit is not protection from the cold. And I literally was good for maybe 10 to 12 minutes before hypothermia would set in.
Wow.
And they would bring me to the surface and then wrap me in blankets and pour warm water over me and start massaging. And then Tom would go in the water and do the same stuff. And then he would come out, and then I was good for maybe another 3 to 5 minutes. And that was our shooting day. The body just couldn't take it.
Man. How long could you hold your breath?
The most I held my breath was 3 minutes and 20 seconds.
Whoa.
And it was phenomenal. It was on a soundstage. We used the old Esther Williams swim tank at MGM. It was the cone tank, an outdoor tank. That they used doing Lifeboat and any number of water shows. And they warmed it. It was just wonderful to be in. It was like a little jacuzzi almost. It was very comfortable. And by then, I had been doing the show a long, long time. And I literally trained myself to expand my lungs and also to, control myself so I could stay underwater longer and longer and longer all the time. And there was one scene where I went down to the bottom of the tank with my safety divers in a tank, scuba tank. And I would hyperventilate with this oxygen. And then when I was ready, the signal would go out and they would race away with my tank, and then the shot would start. And the shot was the 3 minutes and 20 seconds was an underwater cameraman was down there. And once the divers got out of sight, he just started circling me, and the character of Mark Harris was meditating about something. And I was just sitting cross-legged in the sand at the bottom of this tank with a little metal hook where I could hook my finger because I had my lungs full of air and I would float if I didn't. And I sat there, and the rule was, you sit there until you can't anymore, and then you shoot to the surface. And, you know, I was only, 12 feet underwater or so. Mm-hmm. So I just kept sitting there, and it got in a mindset where I literally was there long enough that I thought, I think I can do this. I think I can breathe underwater. I really think maybe just a little bit of water wouldn't hurt me. Maybe I should. And then I thought, what the hell are you? Time to go up. The time on that from the beginning of on camera is probably 2 minutes and 45, 2 minutes, 50 seconds. But from the time my safety divers left me and the shot started to the time I broke surface was 3 minutes and 20 seconds.
Oh, it's an amazing shot. Yeah, it's totally unbroken. One of the most impressive features of the show. Victor Buono coming in. I mean, you talk about camp, Batman. Yeah, I mean, he obviously played King Tut on the Batman show. We got a little more to get. But, man, those television movies. Yep. The first one he was in, I think some of the early episodes. What were just working with him, and what did he bring to the production?
Well, several things he brought, which, these are all, I feel like an old man on a porch now talking my history, but my wife went to school in high school in San Diego, and she had come from New York. She was already an actress. She'd been on Broadway, a singer and a dancer, and so she started doing junior theater. It's called Starlight Opera in San Diego, and one of her classmates in Starlight Opera was Victor Buono. They went to high school together. And he was doing Volpone at the age of 17. That shows you the kind of depth of his acting chops. And so all of a sudden, here's Victor Buono. As soon as I told my wife, they got this actor whom I only knew from Whatever Happened to Baby Jane or Hush, Hush, We Charlotte, whichever one he was in. And I said, that actor from the Betty Davis scary movie is coming to do a part on the show, Victor Buono. Well, she was thrilled because they knew each other, and she came to the set, and it was a whole reunion. So there was this great pre-made friendship that Victor and I had. And he was such a sweetheart. He lived in a little rural community way out in Southern California with his mother. And he was unfortunately very overweight. And that was always a problem because any exertion whatsoever was very difficult for him. But he was one of the more intelligent and well-read, learned people I'd ever worked with up till that point. It was such a joy every day that we ended up working together. It made me laugh uncontrollably. And it was just great fun. And they sort of let him run with his character. Whatever he kind of felt to do, he would do. And some of the stuff is classic. He just on the cuff wrote that one line when he was telling his assistant if he didn't do what he said, he was going to release his photos from the Oxnard
Hotel. That was improv?
Oh, yeah. No, he just made that up during one of the takes. It was so brilliant.
I love that line.
So all of these things. Yeah. Victor was a joy.
Did his character have a first name? I mean, it's always Mr. Schubert, Dr. Schubert. I mean, did they ever talk?
Mr. Schubert.
Okay.
You know what? I think there was a moment when his name was revealed, and maybe that was when he said, if you tell anybody, I'll release the photo from the Oscar Motel. I don't know.
Man.
We never discussed it that I can remember what his name might have been.
Belinda Montgomery, the chemistry between the two of you. And you guys even got the chance to reunite when the DVDs were released. Again, talk about what she brought to it. And, you know, I know they didn't get to flesh out your characters or the relationship that much, but really the chemistry, especially in the television movies, is, you know, off the charts.
Right. No, it was great. And again, I think they missed the boat on that a little bit. But I've had this reoccurring great fortune in my career, and it's happened. It started with Belinda. Well, it started when I did The Last of Mrs. Lincoln. I did my first real piece of film work, and I'm sitting opposite Julie Harris in every scene that I'm in. Mm. And we became instant dear friends. And she was, for that filming period, was my guardian mentor, was my touchstone. Whenever I would do something, I could see in her eye her approval or her, let's try that one more time. And, and this really sort of ushering me forward in my career. And then I got Man from Atlantis, which was really my first series, my first real work like that. And I had a co-star who had been doing television for 10 years and knew it like the back of her hand. It was this total consummate professional. So for the first, especially the pilot, she was my touchstone. I could tell. I would look at her. She would, give me a smile that I knew I'd done a good job, or maybe I should say, guys, can I do that one and try whatever. So she was really the help that I needed to get that started. And then I had Larry when I did Dallas. And I had Suzanne Summers when I did my first sitcom. I had the queen of sitcoms, to look at. And she would give me a wink and a nod when I was doing well. So I've always had these people that it wasn't like I just jumped in and said, I know everything. I jumped in and said, how am I doing, coach? And the coach would tell me if I was, doing okay. And that's what Belinda was. So I trusted her instantly. We had great chemistry. You probably are going to get into this, but I've written the first of a trilogy of Man from Atlantis books, which explores the relationship of Dr. Merrill and Mark Harris.
Okay, that's what I wanted to ask
about. I think it should have been explored.
You led me right into it, because it's that you talked about the shift in tone in that second season, and you got these episodes, mm-hmm. like Shootout at Land's End. And we talk about the evil twin. Where, Mark Harris, he goes, I don't know what it is. He goes through these riffs and then pops up in the Old West. I don't know how that works, but it's sci-fi. So The Naked Montague, all of a sudden you're in a Romeo and Juliet play. I don't know how, but you're there.
Right.
it did get...
Well, you know what this is, and briefly, I know what you're going for, but I want to tell you that, Herb Solo was the executive producer for years on Star Trek, the original television Star Trek. That was Herb Solo and Robert Justman. So their basic premise was the Man from Atlantis is Star Trek underwater. So if you remember all those times that Shatner and Nimoy would all of a sudden be in a gangster movie.
40s gangsters,
or they would be... Or all of a sudden they're at the end of the world and the commies and the Americans have devolved into the troglodytes and they come. So he was tapping into all of these.
Okay.
You can just time warp someplace or you can. That was the justification that they used for that. Not that I agreed with it, but it was the justification.
It makes for some crazy episodes. No, it makes for some crazy and memorable episodes. You get the split screen going and I'm sure you had a blast shooting a Western there too. But from what you said, you didn't really want the series to kind of go in that direction. It was I got a sense in the early television movies, it was more like the $6 Million Man where, they kind of wanted to use Mark Harris as a tool for the government to fight missions and things. That's kind of where going.
Exactly.
Is that kind of where you want to gravitate toward with the novels? Or did you go somewhere different?
Again, no. What I did was I loved the pilot and I loved the first couple of movies. So that's from the point where I think they dropped the ball is where I picked up the fiction of the science fiction of Man from Atlantis. The first, I would say, three chapters of the book are wrapping up the relationship of Dr. Merrill and Mark Harris with the government and sort of explanation of how that ended and it became a private enterprise. But then the title basically is The Return. The Man from Atlantis, the subtitle is called The Return. Mm-hmm. And the first volume is returning to Atlantis, finding out where the source of this entire being that we've come to know as Mark Harris on the surface, what is the history? And it's a whole mythological history and a space science fiction history that gets resolved over the next two volumes of the trilogy. Where it would go after that, I have no idea. It's sort of like getting hit by a car as Bobby Ewing. I've sort of figured that's the end of it. So if they want more, I'm going to have to figure out something else.
Okay, so you approach this from the standpoint that...
split screen as a Western.
Which is awesome. You know, you approached it from the standpoint that he is from Atlantis, because I know they sort of dropped a couple hints on the show that he might be an alien. They never really resolved that.
Right,
but you're
exactly.
You're approaching it from the standpoint that he is from Atlantis, and you're going to explore that.
Well, I'm approaching it from the standpoint that, you know, all of the mythology around the world about the existence of Atlantis is based on something. What is that based on?
Oh, okay.
And if he is a being from whatever that's based on, where did that come from? How did it develop? Oh. What was its function? How long has it been here? Was it always here? Is there a reason for it being here that can be resolved elsewhere? What's, you know, how do other mythologies relate to the Atlantis mythology? I'm grabbing at straws here. What is Mount Olympus and all of the gods of Greek mythology? What is their relationship to our Atlantean mythology? What is the relationship to the Druids? All of these things can, if you approach it properly, you can make connections.
Wow.
Albeit they are connections in science fiction, but if they work, they work. So
okay.
That's my take on volume one, is to establish the ground rules by which I'm going to do volume two and three.
Okay, so when can we...
But getting back to that, what launched this was it does explore the relationship with Dr. Merrill and Mark Harris.
Okay, well, that's what we wanted to see, because it was cut short, and obviously, you know, Belinda's even in the last two episodes. Okay, so when can we hope to see these books, and is there any chance they might be made into television films or even a feature film?
I do not own the rights to anything other than the book form.
Okay.
That was the only thing I negotiated. But that's not to say if a book is popular and if the storyline is likable, then Warner Brothers, who does own all of the product, could definitely say, I want to make a movie of that, or I want to do a TV series of that again, or I want to do a whatever. And then that's what happens. Right now, it's just merely a book, merely, I say with a capital M and lights all over it, but it's a book, and hopefully it'll do well. It's being released, it's on Amazon now in pre-sale.
Okay,
and
so we can order it now.
You can order it now from Amazon Books, which I only found out, shows you how in touch I am. This is why I'm not a businessman. I found it by reading my Twitter people. I was going through my Twitter, and some of the people that follow me went, oh my goodness, I'm so happy. P. Duffy's book, Man from Atlantis, is coming out. And I went, really? So I clicked on what they put on their site, and there it was on Amazon Books, pre-sale and shipping on June 21st.
Okay, so June 21st, 2016. So we'll pre-order it now. We can look forward to less than 6 months. We've got a new man for. Oh, this is sweet. Maybe we'll even get a new comic book out of it too. That'd be. look, I know we're running up against
volume 8.
Yes, exactly. Issue number 8 is what we want. Look, I know I'm up against the clock here. I've got to ask you about one more project that we near and dear to our hearts here. Justice League Animated, the season finale.
Yes.
Season one, 3-part season finale. One of my personal favorite episodes of The Savage Time. You got to play Steve Trevor.
Yes, I did.
Okay. Now, I have to ask you this. Lyle Waggoner played Steve Trevor. He's the one. Look, two versions, mind you. He got to the 40s and the 70s version. Yet you trounced him in Battle of the Network Stars in the obstacle course. 19.9 seconds.
You know,
you flew through this thing. Does that win give you an edge in the Battle of the Trevors?
You know, sometimes you can be overdeveloped, and I think poor Lyle was just too muscular to manage that course. The lithe, intelligent 8 o'clock hero nailed him.
He was the tentacle. I love that obstacle course.
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, those are funny.
Did you ever call Lyle and just go like, "Hey, I got Steve Trevor now."
I still got Steve Trevor. No, but I've met him over the years. It's been interesting to, you know, you do bump. He became quite a businessman and developed a company that probably made him more, not probably, obviously made him more money than ever his film career did. He has this company that has all of the mobile dressing rooms for people.
Yeah.
And he's brilliant at that. You know, I think that's the business side of business, which I really admire. But I haven't talked to him since I did the Trevor. But then, if I remember, that was a while ago too, when I did the cartoony thing, and I think I was like in a home afterwards or something, that she came to visit me. In a home. See, you know more about this than I do.
Yeah, it's a time travel story. They have to go back and reset time because Vandal Savage basically becomes Hitler. Yeah, so you're fighting in the 40s, and then she time travels back to modern day, and you're old at the end. But you guys are the heart of the story.
Yeah, well, I always want to do a comic version of that, though.
Oh,
you know, not a comic, you know, a comedic version when. Because I just think it's so funny if she came and I was an old man and I had absolutely no recollection, you know.
Well,
Steve,
it's
where you're Steve. Who? You? You're Linda. You're Wonder Woman. No, Steve. You're Steve. You don't look like Steve. Oh God! Just go back in time.
That's a whole other episode. Man. Oh, it's one of my favorite episodes. Susan Eisenberg plays Wonder Woman in it. Now, I know with the DC animated universe, a lot of the actors get to work together in studio. Sometimes they're recording dialogue apart. Did you get to work with her in studio?
We were all together in that studio. It was very interesting. They literally had all of the actors playing all of those parts in a little semicircle, all with our microphones. I'm not sure if I was sitting next to her, but I was in the we were all in the same room, and it was the first time I'd done anything like that, which was to me very interesting. I'd done some since then, you know, a goof troop and a few things like that, but that was the first one, and it was funny because every once in a while they'd say cut, they'd go what, and they'd say so and so your stomach grumbled. And I went, ooh, these are sensitive microphones. You can't get anything by these people.
Well, how did you
don't
get
pass
in?
Wind, whatever you do.
Again, that may have been for the latter part of that episode when you're in the retirement home.
The old folks home, right.
So, okay, how did you get involved in the world of DC animation then? Did your agent come to you with a part? Did you know somebody that knew somebody? How did that work out?
I think it was stunt casting.
Okay.
And that happens a lot. They went, a superhero playing in a comic book super thing. Oh, good. Let's see if he wants to do it. And they would do it. And the same way I got on McFarlane's show.
Family Guy.
Family Guy. You know, I'd made more money off of Family Guy practically than I made in Man from Atlantis. Because it's just always on reruns. And that was because he was a big Dallas fan.
Yeah.
He wanted to use a character, and I thought it was great. Same as when I did South Park, which I didn't do. They just put me in there, but it was because they were crazy Man from Atlantis and Dallas fans. I even had a parking place at the production house for South Park.
You weren't even the voice. You were the Patrick Duffy leg.
No, I never met them. I only discovered that they used me when it was on the air. And everybody, wow, that's so cool. I it's not me, but thank you. But for a couple of years, they had the Patrick Duffy parking place in front of their offices.
Only in Hollywood. Only in Hollywood. Look, you mentioned you and Susan Eisenberg working together in that scene. Your characters do kiss twice. How was that recorded?
I think I kissed myself.
Illusion shattered.
I think we did.
Illusion shattered.
All
right.
I'm sorry about that, boss.
Fair enough. No, I knew you had a crush on Linda Carter. You mentioned you had a crush on Linda Carter. You got to kiss that Wonder Woman.
You know what? I gave Linda Carter her first on-screen kiss in her career.
Get out of town.
No. She was never kissed on Wonder Woman. She was never kissed on anything she did. We did a TV movie of a Daniel Steele novel called Daddy. And she played a supermodel, and I played an advertising executive who and I'm divorced, and we start dating, and there is the first kiss. And she was so nervous that she came to me and said, you know, I've never done this. And I said, well, I've done it a lot, so trust me, I'll take care of you. And I gave Linda Carter her first on-screen kiss.
Wow. Yeah. I said it earlier in the interview, you have made some smart choices, my friend. That is certainly one of them. Another smart choice you've made, Major Crimes. You just directed an episode that's set to air February 29th, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. Yes.
All right. What can we expect? Yeah. A lot of directing experience in your background.
A ton of directing experience on shows that I have been on.
Yeah.
I did 30 of the Dallas episodes, 31 if you count the one I did on the new version. I directed 50 or 49, I guess, step-by-step episodes. But I've always been on them. So in one sense, I've had an inside track to the inner workings of not just the show, but the actors' heads. And, everybody works different. Everybody's got things. This is the first time I've gone on a set where I've known no one other than upfront celebrations where networks get together and you meet actors. But I did have the advantage of the executive producer of Major Crimes was our executive producer, Mike Robin, on Dallas, on the new one. So when I directed the Dallas, he asked me if I'd come and do one of his shows, and I did, and it was so rewarding. I can't tell you. I just came today, literally in time to make this phone call from post-production editing of the episode that I did. I really love it. It's the first one of these styles of shows, these procedural shows that are so intricate in terms of imparting information and techniques and lab work and all of this kind of stuff, which was very intriguing to me. And getting emotional performances out of really technical material was not challenging because the actors are brilliant, but challenging for me as a director to see how to work, make it all work. Hopefully, if the show turns out the way they like it, I'll do more because they have been picked up for a new season.
What do you enjoy more, directing yourself in something that you're very familiar with or coming in completely cold and directing somebody from the outside?
I would have said up until this Major Crimes that I enjoyed doing directing myself because, in all honesty, when I'm just acting, there's a part of my mental awareness that is not activated. I'm always thinking, not of, you know, what I'm making for dinner or what color my socks are, but I'm always thinking when I'm acting of the production itself, the position of the cameras, the nuance of the other actors, the positioning of the choreography. All of that's going through my mind while I'm doing my part. So to me, it's a perfect marriage to direct and be in something that you're directing. Up until Major Crimes, when I found myself released from any responsibility on camera, it allowed a more in-depth approach to the acting, directing the actual acting of the actors and the position and the construction of the shots. So it's a different level of appreciation and joy, but it's certainly the equivalent of anything I've ever experienced.
Do you have any upcoming appearances where fans can see you? Anything coming up?
I'm going to gas up at the Arco station in about an hour if anybody wants to drop by.
Go hang out with Mark Harris down at the fill-in station?
Well, I do it in a small yellow swimming suit, so I think they'll know it's me.
Do you still have the trunks?
I have two pairs. And I kept two pairs of trunks. I kept my Scalero lenses. I kept the all the scripts. And those I'm dividing up equally between my two sons so that they can throw them away as soon as I die. And other than that, no.
Last time you wore the trunks.
I don't keep much memorabilia. Last time I wore the trunks, oh, dear God, you know what? I wore the trunks. When we were doing Step by Step, one of the directors on Step by Step, wonderful guy named Rich Carell, so many sidebars to my conversations. Rich Carell is the son of one of the radio actors, Amos and Andy. So there's a little bit of television history.
Let's go
but
back
anyway,
a bit.
Rich Carell every year would do a Halloween party. And so one Halloween, I decided to dress up as the old man from Atlantis. And I bought a pair of support hose, and I padded my stomach and wore a T-shirt over it because I was old, put a big tuft of white chest hair coming out of the T-shirt, glasses, a white wig, and old man slippers, and I put a rubber shark on the end of a leash, and I went as the old man from Atlantis.
Is there a picture of this
that
anywhere?
Was the last time I ever put in my scrapbook, which will never see the light of day.
All right, so you do have them.
That
then
was the last time I put on the swim trunk, because those trunks were god awful. You know, nowadays there's spandex and there's the superhero outfits that are to die for. That was basically terry cloth, just a sewn together swimming suit made out of terry cloth that, when it got wet, weighed about 100 pounds and looked like you were a 6-month-old carrying a load in your diaper. It was the worst swimming suit in the world.
Yeah, and it wasn't much terry cloth either.
So, no, it wasn't much terry cloth, no. And so that was not the most joyous suit to wear, I must tell you. So,
The website is patrickduffy.org?
Yes. I think I have them all. So anyone will get you there. Patrickduffy.com and patrickduffy.org will both go to the website. Yeah. Which I use the Man from Atlantis opening for my website.
I love that. You click on that, and you're taken right back into the Man from Atlantis.
Yeah, because it was that important to me. It really was. I look at that as the beginning of everything that graces my life to this day. It started there. It started with my wife, but professionally it started right there. And it's very important to me. And that's why I wanted to treat that history with respect by writing the book. It was the sole reason I wanted to write the book.
Looking forward to that. All these years later, we're still talking about it. Can't wait to see the next adventures of Mark Harris and Dr. Merrill.
Elizabeth Merrill.
Dr. Elizabeth Merrill. And Twitter, @TheRealPDuffy.
Yep.
We can follow you there. We'll find out. We will follow you. Patrick, on behalf of my listeners, I want to thank you for those classic roles we talked about, all those TV shows, the movies.
Oh, Joe, thank you very much.
I look forward to seeing what you got in store. Looking forward to more directing. Definitely that book. And I thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
And order a pizza, because I know the basement gets really lonely. So at least you'll have the delivery person to talk to down there.
It is a little lonely in the lair. That's true. Always learning something new here at Comic Book Central. Never knew that Patrick was in on those early Raiders of the Lost Ark casting sessions. So I thought I knew a whole lot about Indiana Jones. But right there's some great Indiana Jones trivia right there. I'm going to have to play a little bit of that interview over at theindycast.com, I think. The Indiana Jones podcast run by Ed Dalista. Cool that we got to hear about that story today. A little bit about Star Wars there. My thanks again to Patrick for joining me on the show today. His website is patrickduffy.com. You go there, the Man from Atlantis is waiting for you right there on the homepage, trust me. You can also follow Patrick on Twitter @TheRealPDuffy. And you can like Patrick. We all like Patrick, right? You can like him online. Go online. Facebook @Facebook.com/PatrickDuffyActor. Give the page a like. While you're surfing online with the Man from Atlantis, be sure to head over to my website. You're going to find all the links to the pages I mentioned. They're going to be in the show notes for this episode. It's comicbookcentral.net. All the past episodes are in the archive there on the website. They're also on iTunes, so if you subscribe to the show, you get them all that way. Please, again, leave a review if you're there. It really helps to get the word out to everybody. The show's also on Stitcher, Blueberry. Follow me on Twitter @comicbookctrl. Retweet the show, get it out there, #ShareTheLair. You can also share it on Facebook. Just click share when I post it there. Comic Book Central Network over there on Facebook. And you guys have been quiet. I want to hear from you. I want to hear from all you listeners. Take a minute. Drop me a line. Inundate the inbox. Put my virtual mailman, Willie Lumpkin, to work. If you got an episode of Man from Atlantis that you really like, let me know about it. Did you like the direction it took when it was picked up as a regular series? Tell me about it. Did you like the comedic turn? What are some of your favorite comic book themed movies and TV shows? Let me know. What talented folks would you like to hear from? Send me your lists. Can't promise I can get them all on the phone, but it is certainly fun to try. There's probably a lot of folks out there that I forgot about or haven't even thought of, so let me know what you think. Drop me a line, joe@comicbookcentral.net, or you can click the Signal Me tab right there on the website. All right, folks, that is all the time we have for today. My look back at Man from Atlantis has just begun, because next week on Comic Book Central, the woman who rescued the man from Atlantis is going to be here. Hey, without her, Patrick Duffy would still have been on the beach. He never would have made it back into the water. The amazingly talented actress who brought beauty and brains to the bridge of the submarine Cetacean as Dr. Elizabeth Merrill. Actress Belinda Montgomery will join me here in the lair next time. Until then, just keep swimming. Just keep swimming. Have a wonderful week. Keep reading those comics. Thanks for joining me here in the lair. Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations 3.0 Imported License. All other content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of their respective holders.
The weirdest dream. I dreamt I saw the strangest episode of Family Guy, and there was a giant chicken, and Stewie was an octopus.
Hey, come on now. It's all right. Everything's gonna be okay. What's Family Guy?